Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Envestnet's annual market outlook call, featuring a panel of investment experts from Envestnet PMC, Capital Group, and Vanguard. Our speakers today are Alexis Gray, economist in Vanguard's Investment Strategy Group, David Pollock, Equity Investment Director at Capital Group, Brandon Thomas, Chief Investment Officer at Envestnet PMC, and the discussion will be moderated by Zachary Carabel, Head of Global Strategies for Envestnet. For your reference, all lines have been placed into a listen-only mode to prevent background noise. If you would like to submit a question, please type it into the Q&A console, which can be located on your GoToWebinar screen. We will attempt to answer as many of your questions as possible during the Q&A portion of the call. If you have any technical difficulties, please email madeline.smith@investnet.com for assistance. Additionally, we will be recording today's event and will make it available shortly after the call. I will now turn it over to Zachary to begin the session.
Thank you very much, and thanks in advance to David, Alexis, and Brandon for joining us today. Obviously, we're going to be in for an eventful few months, to say the least, based on the upcoming inauguration of Donald Trump the end of next week. I think as a preface to what everyone's going to say, we all feel, and I think I am speaking for all of us, and if I'm not, I apologize, but that we all feel that there are a certain number of things that are structural going on in markets, whether that's some of the rotation from bonds into equities, or at least some of the slowing of the bond bull market that's been with us for 30 years, that there is some indication of rising interest rates, at least in the developed world, or the end of the easiest money policies that we saw in the wake of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, and some degree of renationalization or a pause in globalization. And those things are kind of I don't know where that's coming from. I apologize. That those trends are kind of structural and in place and not likely to be easily changed by any particular set of political processes or policies. There's also a huge X. Can someone mute? There seems to be some background. There are a huge number of X factors as well that will have to do with exactly what follows from a Trump administration. What kinds of executive orders are issued, meaning those things that can become policy, what kinds of executive orders are issued and then challenged to the courts, particularly around trade, and then what Congress passes or doesn't pass around healthcare, stimulus, tax reform. And while it's very easy to game out what those things might be, none of us know what they're going to be, and I think all of us would advise not to overly try to position portfolios based on guessing what direction these things are going to go, because none of us really know. So just keeping that in mind, which is it's certainly possible that in a month some of these questions will need to be revisited because of some of these issues and what does in fact transpire politically. And then many of these questions are not subject to the whims of politics, meaning regardless of what happens within the political process in the United States, regardless of what happens with the German elections this year, the French elections this year, some of these trends in terms of global capital, interest rates, aggregate demand, emerging middle class, they're both David and Alexis. Please try to mute your line. Some of these issues are going to be evergreen and not susceptible to change based on politics, and some of them are. So keep an eye on what the first 100 days of a Trump administration hold, given that the promise has been to undo some regulations and pass rather significant structural legislation in terms of tax reform and health care. We could find some fundamental factors adjusting more than is typical with a new administration. Although, frankly, 2009 brought a lot of change between the stimulus bill that Congress passed in February 2009 after Obama was in office and in the middle of that crisis, as well as healthcare reform and some of the bank bailouts. So it's not unusual for there to be some dramatic changes at the beginning of a new administration. It just bears watching and witnessing. Personally, and kind of speaking for myself, speaking somewhat from my vantage at Envestnet, I do think it is usually precipitous and a mistake to try to position portfolios ahead of politics or to try to anticipate the political effects. We've seen a huge market rally, maybe not huge, but a pretty substantial U.S. market rally, quite substantial in U.S. small caps since the election of Trump. We've seen a rally in the commodity complex. We've seen a number of companies that could presumably benefit from stimulus spending do very well in the equity markets. Often these names have been up 20, 30%, some even more. And that's a classic case of equity markets in particular anticipating potential effects of future policy and trying to get a jump on it. Similarly, healthcare names have sold off because of perception that there might be some real chaos and pricing issues within the healthcare complex. Those may prove to be the right trades, but they really are just that, they're trades. And you know, we need to be mindful of trades as a way of managing. And I think that's just something to keep in mind. Clients are often anxious about the political effects and want people to factor those in, but I think you always have to be cautious about how much you do so and then really look more at what's likely to be a larger factor structurally over time as opposed to what might just be a passing issue over time. So with that in mind, we are going to go alphabetically from Alexis to David to Brandon to talk about their views of the world and the markets as they currently see them. I'll then lead a conversation. And again, just speaking for Envestnet, we are hosting this. Our investment team is always present to engage all of you in these questions and conversations about interest rates, about market valuations, about global developments, about political developments, and how these all might shape portfolios and client discussions. So this is one discussion that we're having today with three very informed individuals, but we are always here to have these conversations, and I hope you'll turn to us for them. And I guess my final thoughts in all this are markets are often debates amongst people with different points of view about where opportunities and risks lie. Rarely are they conclusive and evident, meaning it's rare that someone is completely right and completely wrong, and we see these kind of conversations and these kind of seminars as part of a conversation that shapes markets and is absolutely vital to continue to have because it's part of how we all figure out where those opportunities are short, long, midterm, and where those risks are short, long, and midterm. So that, I'm going to turn it over to Alexis, and each of them will speak for 5 to 7 minutes and give their overview.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody, or good evening from here in London. You know, I think I sort of would echo those opening points that 2016 surely was an eventful year. I think this time 12 months ago, very few people would have predicted that, firstly, that Britain would vote to leave the EU, and that in addition, Donald Trump would be elected president in the US. And I think even fewer people still would predict that at year end, after both of those two events, that we would have had the bond and stock returns that we have had. So from the perspective of a US investor, around 9% for a global stock portfolio and around 5% for a global bond portfolio. So really the market has absorbed both of those two, what we'd consider to be tail risk events, fairly well. And I think heading into 2017, politics is going to matter again, you know, both in the US and in Europe. You know, with Donald Trump coming in, you know, very shortly. It's been interesting to watch that business sentiment has picked up in the wake of the election. And so as a result of this, we can see that business investment will probably tick up this year and hiring as well. So we anticipate that growth will be a little higher than what we'd thought previously, centering around 2.5% as our best guess. that the unemployment rate will probably fall below 4.5%. Both of these factors will likely lead the Fed to hike interest rates 2 and possibly even 3 times. So, you know, we can see by the end of the year the Fed funds rate getting up to around 1.5% with a reasonable probability, which is really good news for bond investors having higher rates and higher coupon payments. Over in Europe, as I mentioned, you know, I think we'll also have a lot of political news. You have the UK now entering negotiations to leave the EU. At some point in the next few months, they'll start that two-year negotiation. And so that should be a slight drag on growth, but we anticipate around 1.5% growth in the UK and in the euro area. I think the bigger thing to watch is really this growing euro skepticism. You know, Brexit was one manifestation of the euro skepticism, but we have elections coming up in the Netherlands, in France and in Germany this year. And although we don't expect, you know, a hard Eurosceptic party to be elected to government, so we won't necessarily see a party who wants out of the Euro or out of the European Union in power, they're getting enough share of the vote now that they could start to push government policy, you know, to sort of make some of those arrangements a bit more flexible. So that's the sort of tail risk event that we're watching for this year. And then, of course, over in Asia, you've had the sleeping dragon. China hasn't really been making headlines recently because we've had so much focus on the West, but China should grow at a, you know, a reasonable pace, 6 to 6.5%, which is, you know, not a hard landing by any means, but you know, gradually slowing down as we'd expect an emerging country would do. So then what does this all imply for an investor? Well, at Vanguard, we tend not to provide short-term forecasts of stock and bond returns because we acknowledge how difficult it is to do so, but we tend to look over a 10-year horizon. So for stocks, we have a median projection of 5 to 8%, and for bonds, it's about 1.5 to 2.5%. So we've sort of seen our median projections for equities falling a little over recent years because the market now has higher valuations. You know, we've seen record highs in the S&P 500 recently, but still that's a reasonable return really for an investor. And in the bond market, with a gradual rise in interest rates, that's really good news. But for the time being, with rates coming off such a low base, we think 1.5 to 2.5% is a good median projection on average over the next decade. And so with that, I might just hand over back to Zachary.
Thanks, Alexis. Just one more question for you before we turn over to David. Do you feel with the recent strength of the United States versus the rest of the world, certainly in terms of equity markets, and now with a different yield profile, that there's going to be more? Do you see this continuing? Do you see whole question of reversions mean, you know, typically investors and asset allocators thought, well, you know, if market X does really well relative to others, then eventually that means the others are going to catch up or there'll be some reversion. And we just haven't seen that with U.S. equities versus the rest of the world. And now with bond yield strength, I'm just wondering how you, is this going to be driven by fundamentals and sentiment, or is it going to be driven by sort of more typical traditional metrics?
I think the market's rallied for a couple of reasons. One is that there's an expectation now that business investment will be higher, which I think is, you know, that seems like it will, you know, is a realistic assumption. But the other part of it, of course, is the assumption that Trump will push through tax cuts and infrastructure spending. And so that fiscal stimulus could really boost growth. But I think that maybe the market's getting a little bit ahead of itself on that one. It's, you know, remains to be seen how much of those policies he can actually push through, how much he can actually get done. I think there are plenty of fiscal conservatives who'd be worried about raising the amount of debt that the US government has already. So, you know, I think that the market may be slightly ahead of itself. So not necessarily to say there'd be a correction, but, you know, I don't know how much further the rally can continue.
Good to know. I'm sure we'll come back to that a bit and maybe David will have some thoughts. So let's turn it over to David.
Thank you very much, and I'd better have some thoughts on that after the introduction. So again, echo Alexis, greetings to everyone. And like both the previous speakers, 2016 was a watershed. One of the things at Capital Group we're trying to figure out is what kind of watershed. We've had a deflationary environment since the great financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. What 2016 seem to be suggesting when one looks back is that maybe there's more inflation than the market was anticipating this time next year. one of the questions is how much more? And if you're going to see considerably more inflation, considerably more cyclical growth, then that has enormous implications, as mentioned, for things like equities versus bonds, but also for relationships like value versus growth. And as Zachary touched on, US equities versus non-US equities, because there is far more imagination or innovation in the US stock market, particularly in the area of technology and internet and biotech. And there's far more cyclical exposure outside the United States in areas like commodities and banking. And so if you see more inflation, if you see more cyclical growth in market participants' outlook, there is a reasonable chance that non-US equities will begin to break this something like 8-year losing streak they've been on since the great financial crisis. One of the issues we face is that this time each year, somebody like me comes on a call like this and says, now is the time for non-US equities. It's the boy who cried wolf. We will see. But the arguments seem to be building up in case for the case for geographical diversification. And one of the things that Capital Weird suggests is take a look at your weightings. This isn't a binary outcome. It's not either U.S. equities or non-U.S. equities. It's what is the weighting? Are you diversified enough? Will you look back in a few years and think that you missed the boat in terms of the opportunities available in non-U.S. equities? So if we go back to this longer-term view, Capital, much like Vanguard, we look for something around 8 to 10 years out. We pay our portfolio managers on their returns over an 8-year component as well as some shorter-term periods. And in the early 2000s, commodities were cheap. Immediately post the great financial crisis, growth was cheap. There is a reasonable argument that as we enter 2017, inflation or cyclicality looks cheap. And that could lead you, as you listen to my comments, to think that this is a knock on U.S. equities. And we still find at Capital Group selective opportunities. We build portfolios from the bottom up, and we still find a lot to like in the U.S. But despite the non-U.S. issues around European Euroscepticism, Japanese demographic issues, and this whole question of where China's going, we do find opportunities. And of course, outside the United States, that would include the emerging markets. On a valuation basis, Europe, Japan, and the emerging markets, again, selectively, look pretty interesting. One question that does need to be answered is, what happens to China? And here, again, we'd agree with Vanguard. We think this is not a, whether it's a hard landing or a soft landing. We think China's going through a long landing. They have, the authorities in China have a longer term outlook than even Vanguard or even Capital. They are playing a very long game, and they can absorb the debts that they're building up, we believe, at Capital. And the growth may not be 6, 6.5, it may be 4, 5 in some negative outlooks, but that's still very steady and decent growth for the second largest economy in the world. One question that's being asked as we come into the new year is this the end of globalization? Are we seeing a new world order? Or were the Brexit votes and the vote here in the United States some cry from the middle class to go back to the 1950s and get rid of globalization? And our view is that you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's very difficult to unwind supply chains that have been in place for 10 years. Globalization nowadays is as much about communications being cheap as it was about transportation being cheap. And that means that today globalization is as much about the transfer of digital ideas versus the movement of stuff. And that's harder to put tariffs on. That's harder for governments, even the US government, to control. We do think that globalization is going to change shape. And as ever at Capital, we're going to focus on companies that are set up to take advantage of those changes and those opportunities. And finally, maybe a word about passive versus active. This is a debate that has taken on a religious intensity of two orthodoxies, at least in the media. We believe at Capital Group there's room for both. It's natural that advisors, that investors want to control what they can control, and that is cost. But maybe the word, the phrase I'll leave, or the thought I'll leave before passing on, is that whilst it's great to control costs, and academic literature suggests that the costs of investments are a very essential part of the returns you get over the long term, and that's a memo to all active managers. Whilst it's good to control costs, advisors mustn't lose sight of long-term outcomes. It's easy to do that because they're much harder to control if you can control them at all, but you mustn't lose sight of them, because if you do and you control the costs, what you may end up with are clients who don't have enough money to retire on, don't have enough money to send their kids to college. So it's an existential question that faces the whole industry, and happy to come back to that in questions and answers, but I'll leave off here.
Well, it's good to have existential questions, which are by nature challenging and hard to resolve. And maybe we will indeed come back to those. So thank you, David, for that overview. And let's turn it now to Brandon Thomas of InvestNet for some maybe more domestic and valuation and other market thoughts, or whatever else is on Brandon's ever interesting mind.
Zachary, thanks very much, and good afternoon, everybody. I listened to Alexis and David not only for their insightful comments, but also for their great British accents. So I'll have the Chicago accent here on this call. I'll be the panelist that doesn't speak like a Brit. But at InvestNet PMC, we would agree almost completely with everything that Alexis and David were talking about. Last year, of course, was a year where the equity markets in particular had to navigate several different events. Brexit, of course, being one of the primary ones earlier in the year. And then the outlook for the European Union. What does that mean going forward? Alexis mentioned that there are other countries in the Union that are going to have votes this year. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with the European Union going forward in 2017. Of course, there was the U.S. elections and the lead up to that, and then the prospect of a Fed rate hike. The markets, both the equity market and fixed income markets, were trying to struggle with how soon and how much the Fed would raise rates. And then it became very apparent that December was going to be the date, and then the market, the 10-year yield started to take off. But the equity market did a very nice job of discounting events throughout the year. If you recall, after that precipitous drop early in the year, the equity market here, at least domestically, the S&P 500 bottomed in the middle of February, and it took off. And really, there was no change in the economic outlook that was apparent. And so it went on this very nice rally up until Brexit at the end of June. It did a little bit of a dip at that point, but then immediately, as soon as the Brexit vote was known, immediately started taking off again. And it did something similar leading up to the U.S. election, where it rallied into October, then took a dip, but then as soon as the election results were known, it took off again. So the market did a very nice job, I think, of discounting events in 2016, and perhaps that could lead into 2017 as well. Predictably, we've already seen the Democrats start to dig in their heels on some of the cabinet nominations and the upcoming Supreme Court nomination, so I'm not sure what that bodes for legislation going forward. But as Zachary mentioned at the outset, I think we have to take, we don't know at this point. There's a lot out there. There's a lot that's been proposed. The markets have really been encouraged by some of the policies that have been set forth by President-elect Trump, but no one knows at this point what's going to pass and become policy. I'd just like to talk very briefly about asset classes and the importance of diversification. I think, as we always state here at InvestNet PMC, diversification is key for most investors. You want to be broadly diversified across domestic and international, and then within the fixed income segment, you want to have diversification there as well. And that paid off in 2016, and it will almost certainly pay off in 2017. I think, like David, I think there could be this transition from domestic outperformance to international outperformance, whether that's valuation-based or more sentiment-based looking ahead, not sure. But at some point, there's going to be a snapback of international equities, and it's good to be to have that diversification. So if you haven't rebalanced portfolios, and if you're overweight, your clients are overweight domestic at this point due to the rallies that we've seen relative to international, may be an appropriate time to rebalance portfolios back to their target mix just to get exposures where you want them to be. Sector performance in 2016 was varied, and that leads me to believe that this active-passive discussion that David talked about, there may be more dispersion in returns across securities in equities and then fixed income and other asset classes. And so active management it may come to the fore a little bit more here going forward. But sector performance was very strong in certain sectors such as energy and financials. And since Election Day, especially, that's been the case, primarily because of the policy pronouncements that President-elect Trump has made. And of course, European markets have had a more difficult time navigating some of the issues such as the slowdown in China. And we would agree with both Alexis and David that it's not a hard landing. It's something that the Chinese are handling very well, and we think will be beneficial to that region going forward. Commodities also performed well last year, and they have especially so since the election. And REITs have actually performed very well since the election. They were basically flat throughout the year as, you know, very interest rate sensitive. They were flat throughout the year as bonds fell, but then they rallied somewhat here since the election. So diversification is very key. A couple of other points. What's driven performance over the last 12 months, and what is likely to going forward? Some of the factors we look at. Factors are determinants, dimensions that drive stock returns: size, value, momentum, quality. Those are the primary factors that we look at, and the many academic researchers look at. Size, meaning smaller cap stocks and value-oriented stocks, performed extremely well in 2016, and since the election, they've performed very, very well. And I would agree with David that that may indicate that there's a transition to more cyclical type of names, and that's typically what you see when value stocks start to perform well, is that cyclical names jump out of the box and they do very, very well. And momentum and quality were the factors that performed very poorly. So it's sort of an about face from what happened the previous year, where value performed very poorly and momentum performed very well, but value came back very strongly. And that is another indication that the market was discounting what may be ahead. These pro-growth policies may result in acceleration in growth, and so that could be very beneficial to companies that have been out of favor, emerging markets type of companies, commodity-related companies, financials, et cetera. So what may perform well going forward? Value. You know, if you believe David, and there may be this transition to cyclical names, value could continue to perform very well going forward, because it's more tied to the business cycle, and so we'd say that value is likely to do very, very well going forward. Momentum and quality are still factors that you're going to want to have exposure to. So like with your normal portfolio, you're going to want to have diversification as between more growth-oriented stocks and more quality-oriented stocks as well. Let me just briefly end up with a short discussion on alternatives. It was a very difficult year last year for alternative investments. I think, as probably everybody knows, there's been a lot written in the press about the demise of large hedge funds and the cutbacks at these funds and the poor performance and endowments leaving alternatives and going more into the traditional asset classes. Almost every segment of the hedge fund world had a difficult time last year. the most popular categories, hedged equity, was actually flat on the year when the S&P was up about 12%, which is very difficult. Non-traditional bond funds actually generated about a 5% return in a difficult environment for fixed income, so that is a benefit. So advisors that have had exposure to non-traditional bond funds to mitigate the expected rise in interest rates, those paid off last year. Market neutral performed very poorly, declining about 5%, and then managed futures also declined about 3%. So over the past 5 years or so, global hedge fund indices, just sort of the aggregate indices, have generated an annualized return of only about 1.6%. And that compares to the S&P 500's 14.7% return. So you can see why investors shy away from using alternatives, particularly when the market has been rallying as it has over the last 7 years. However, we're in the seventh year of a bull market now, with elevated valuations, maybe not extreme, but elevated valuations at this point, at least on a trailing basis. And there's some degree of uncertainty around the economic policies going forward and what's going to be implemented. Alternatives can still add value in client portfolios where the advisor is interested in mitigating risk and the downside return. And so we would say, much like these other asset classes and factors, if you're predisposed to using alternatives, don't throw in the towel just because of the poor performance recently. Do some research and make sure that you get the exposure to the alternative segments that your client needs, and then allocate appropriately. And that can pay dividends if the market does dip, and it just provides that nice buffer if things get a little bit volatile. So with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks so much, Brendan. And just a reminder to the assembled, please do send in your questions via the webinar under the question tab through the Citrix GoToWebinar panel, and we will try to answer those questions as they show up. So I guess a question for all of you, which each of you have touched on, but I actually want to first go to something David had mentioned, because it's crucial to our industry and assets and how people invest right now, this kind of passive and active question, which I think a lot of us have given some thought to. And maybe each of you could address this in a little more depth. We probably all agree that there's a role for both active and passive, either in a core satellite fashion. The marketplace is certainly flooded with a lot of positive news about passive in terms of lower costs and access. There was an op-ed today by one of the founders of BlackRock pushing back against some of the critique of index funds. Maybe each of you could talk a little bit more about how this works, where these vehicles are effective, where they're not. Alexis, I'm sure you've thought about there are whole areas of the globe where one can invest that are not well represented by passive funds, or the passive funds that represent them don't represent them well. So just maybe kind of educate us about what the pros and cons are here, and then this may be a case where shades of gray are more effective than black and white answers.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that our view is that there's a role for both active and passive, which is precisely why we offer both. I think Vanguard's very well known for offering index funds, but we also have quite a number of active funds. I mean, the way that we would talk about it with a client is that there is a role for both, and it really depends on your ability to select active managers who can outperform. So, a good starting point for the average investor is to hold a portfolio that contains only index funds. So you choose your asset allocation and then use index funds to fill that out. But where you can select managers who may be able to outperform, and like you said, that may be in certain niche markets where you can't get full access, or perhaps you have a manager in your local market who you believe can add value over time, then you can opt to choose an active manager as well. But I mean, obviously active has come under a lot of pressure in recent years because performance hasn't been in some cases hasn't been good enough. If you look at sort of rolling 3, 5, and 10 year windows, active managers in the large part have struggled to beat a benchmark. And so that's why you've seen a lot of people moving out of active and into passive. And there's been this a lot of pressure as well on active managers to reduce fees in order to compete with passive funds. So I think that trend of reducing costs is going to continue to put pressure on managers, to lower their costs and to continue to try and provide alpha. But I guess that's a summary of how we would view it. Is there's a role for both, but it depends on your ability to pick managers.
Zachary, I just jump in here and agree completely with Alexis, and I just say that what investors really need is exposure to those asset classes, whether they get it through a passive vehicle or an active vehicle. And they just, in order to generate returns and and obtain the long-term objectives, achieve those objectives, you just want exposure to those asset classes. And so first and foremost, you just want to make sure you do that in the most efficient way. We've done a lot of research here at PMC about this active-passive question, and we've identified asset classes that over time it makes sense to be passive in, and other asset classes that are less efficient where you can identify active managers. But again, I'd agree with Alexis and say that if you've got the ability to identify active managers that perform well, not only in the past, but prospectively going forward, and that's a hard thing to do, of course, but if you've got a research team or the capability of doing that, then you can, then it makes a lot of sense to go active in those asset classes. And I think the key is just making sure that that you have exposure to those asset classes, you're paying a reasonable fee, and that you can truly identify those active managers that will perform well. I think for smaller accounts, we've seen a lot of advisors simply use ETFs in portfolios just to get that exposure. They may not meet the minimums for active managers, and absolutely having a portfolio completely passive is just fine. And then as you graduate in terms of account size, something that combines active and passive makes a lot of sense.
So I'd pose a couple of questions to the audience. The first one is, one reaction in the move to passive is how difficult it is to pick active managers. I would ask the audience to maybe just reflect on how difficult it is to pick asset classes. So in some ways, the move to passive has simply shifted the risk away from the manager, because there now is no active manager, to the person, that could be an advisor, a pension fund, a sponsor, who is making the asset allocation shifts. So most risk mitigation strategies that we've seen over the decades have simply shifted the risk from one bucket to another. And our suspicion is there is some of that going on here. The second question is, we've had a period of, you know, maybe 8 years of significant central bank intervention. And that's been a massive distortion that has led to binary macro outcomes. That's a period when passive is going to be the right way to go. Question that the audience should be asking themselves is, do they think the next 8 years or 10 years is going to be the same? Because of course, what we also notice from markets when we look back over history is people tend to put their money on the winning hand, which isn't necessarily the winning hand going forward. Investment is a counter-cyclical business. It's very difficult to do. And then this comes back to the question of, why is it hard to pick active managers? There's a million reasons that we don't have time to go into, and I don't fully understand, to be perfectly honest. But I think some of the work we have done is try to identify how can advisors make life easier for themselves. And one way is to focus on funds where the portfolio managers have skin in the game. And the other is to focus on portfolio managers, active managers, where the fees are low. And were you to take the highest quartile of investment by portfolio managers, and you can see that on Morningstar, and if you were to take the lowest quartile by fees and screen across managers, the results are quite significant. We wrote a paper on this, and there's something like 2,000 US equity funds over 20 years, and if you screened for those two factors, skin in the game, low fees, that 2,000 reduced to something like 100, and the returns for those 100 were dimensionally better than the 2,000 in general. Which brings us back to Alexis's point, which is the focus on fees is absolutely laser-like. And the active reaction is going to be twofold. One, it's going to be a, pardon the pun, passive response, which is just frankly hope that their returns start getting better, that the dispersion that Brandon talked about begins to pick up, you begin to see active managers making sense, greed begins to trump fear in the minds of advisors and investors. The other is a more active response, which is to cut fees. Bear in mind that if fees are cut, you're going to see a reduction of choice. There are a lot of portfolio management firms, asset management firms, that cannot succeed given their size with a much lower level of fees. The firms that will do well will be the firms that are in, that are represented on this call.
So another question I would have, thank you all for that.
I think this is going to continue to be, you know, a crucial one. Brandon and I have certainly thought a lot about this on our end, given that InvestNet covers a variety of index, passive, and active funds, you know, where that works. So sort of picking up what Alexa said, it's certainly true it's hard to find active managers who beat the market when there are really good index vehicles or passive vehicles that cover the waterfront. That may be less true in certain areas like emerging markets, like certain types of higher yielding debt, where there is either less liquidity or more variety or smaller cap names, you name it. And so, you know, this is going to continue to evolve, but I think our view is to caution against putting all one's eggs in a passive basket or an active, particularly if you're an advisor trying to balance out risk. And I think this is going to play itself out over the coming years, particularly in an interesting way if we see whether or not the Department of Labor fiduciary rule, which had been all set to go into effect, but which the incoming Trump administration has been making noises, it may delay or shelve. I don't think that's going to change either the fiduciary standard or some of the drive into passive, i.e. pick the lower cost vehicle when given a choice, but it's certainly going to add yet another question mark to something we, I think, had thought was more of a done deal. Let me push all of you a little bit on this question of, you know, I've been thinking a lot about if you had listened to most of the conventional wisdom in the marketplace for the past 3 years, it would have suggested that the developed and developing markets relative to U.S. equity markets were attractive, that they were less pricey relative to future potential earnings than U.S. equities, and that you would have somewhat overweighted the world relative to the U.S. And that clearly has not worked. Similarly, there's been a long view that this 30-year bond bull market was getting long and probably going to come to an end. Until 2 or 3 months ago, that has also proven to be premature at best. I'm wondering where you all see, as of January 2017, these questions. Are investors going to be looking toward kind of where they think there are fundamental opportunities, and things like valuation and price are just becoming less important, just like investors used to look about money supply as an indication of whether there's future inflation? And I doubt any of us have talked about money supply much for years and years and years. I mean, there are metrics and ways of looking at the world that come into favor and fall out of favor. So I'm just wondering if some of the questions about valuation are just less important to investors than where opportunities lie, where safety lies, where yield lies, and what that does to our sense of asset allocation in the year ahead. And if you could all address that.
So my reaction to that is, the moment we ask the question of does valuation matter anymore is the moment when it matters the most. Valuations in Europe very much reflect these macro factors that have been guiding markets for the last 8 years. You have unpleasant demographics. You have a political construct that's under pressure. You have much lower growth as a consequence of both of these things than you're seeing elsewhere in the world. And you have a lot of uncertainty in the shape of elections. And so when you look at the world through a macro lens, the non-US looks more challenging than maybe the US does. But when you look at it from a bottom-up perspective, that's when the valuations begin to matter. Valuations company by company in the same industry are typically somewhat to significantly lower for non-US companies. And bear in mind that for many of those companies, their competitive advantage has significantly improved. So for a company that sells in euro versus, say, a US competitor, that euro-based company is now 25% more competitive in markets like China because the euro over 2 years has devalued by about a quarter. Same for Japanese companies in terms of the yen. That's yet to play through because the market is continues to be focused on these big macro issues rather than company-specific issues. So our view is that when company-specific issues begin to kick in, the market will change its focus, and maybe it'll be a shift towards looking at more inflation. Maybe it'll be the market beginning to break apart and seeing some more dispersion. I also think we have a slight issue in our industry that we always try and call these changes in January. We, for reasons that I think are understandable in terms of how we organize ourselves, look to an outlook for a calendar year. But of course, the world doesn't work in calendar years. And so the fact that many people have said each January that the non-US markets are going to begin to look better for a lot of the reasons I mentioned is probably an outcome of our structure. But sooner or later, that elastic band stretches too far.
So what do you think, Alexis, and then Brandon, on this question?
I mean, I think I would echo David's points, and I think people have been saying for several years that the US market looks more stretched than other markets, and just because that hasn't reversed itself doesn't mean that it never will. We may just be further along in that cycle with the elastic band pulling further. I mean, there is a possibility that we get some pullback. And as I mentioned earlier, we sort of have a 10-year horizon when we look at our forecasts, and we have, I think for the last several years, our US outlook being marginally lower than our global outlook for equities, and that persists now as well. So I think, it takes some time for these things to play out. Although it hasn't happened yet, doesn't mean that it won't still. So I think we continue to feel that there's a marginally higher outlook for non-US stocks than US stocks, because valuations look more attractive, particularly in emerging markets where valuations are substantially lower. I think in the bond market, I mean, obviously that's been very difficult to predict. For 6 years now, people have been calling the end of the bond market rally, and it hasn't come about. Are we there now? Possibly, or it may just be that we have, interest rates oscillating in a lower range than where they were pre-crisis. So we see the Fed raising rates gradually, but not getting back to pre-crisis levels for a whole host of reasons, lower growth because of demography and other global factors. So, I think bond returns are likely to be somewhat muted. We're not going to get a massive sell-off. We're not going to necessarily have a perfect reversal of the trend that we've just had of yields coming down. We may just stay hovering at this lower level. So, we're not particularly scared of some sort of bond bubble crashing, just a sort of gradual rise in interest rates, which, as I mentioned earlier on the call, is welcome for long-term investors because that implies higher coupon payments. So that's my view on those two things.
And Zachary, yes, I would agree completely. I think we've seen this outperformance of U.S. equities relative to both developed markets and emerging markets over the last 8 years. And that sort of corresponds with this very aggressive Fed policy that has been in place. So the Fed has been much more aggressive than the ECB, for example. And so that's been supporting the U.S. equity market, I would argue, relative to international, developed, and emerging markets. And so one wonders if this normalization of Fed interest rate policy, where we're getting back to something that's more historically normal, like you and I remember the 80s when we would hang on Henry Kaufman's every word at Salomon Brothers about the money supply and what his outlook was. And we could be getting back to a more normal environment now where interest rates matter, where fundamentals matter, et cetera. So that could be a driver of moving back into having a better outlook for international equities. And then the other thing I would say is that markets, as I alluded to earlier, markets do a very good job of discounting these types of events prior to them happening, several months, a year in advance. We saw that this past year with the U.S. equity market, where there was, everything was looking very dire last February at the bottom after we had fallen 5 or 6%. And then all of a sudden the equities take off for no real reason. There was no news or anything like that. And so when things start to turn, it may not be apparent to us. There is, the outlook for Europe, on its face isn't as good as the U.S. But at some point the equity market will make that pivot, and it will turn. And so it may come upon us as a surprise, but I think it will eventually happen. I think that's why it's good to have a diversified portfolio rebalanced back to target allocations.
Yeah, I mean, I am probably, for what it's worth, more willing than David to entertain the idea that certain metrics are less valuable in understanding where assets should be flowing. And that's why I use the money supply M2, M1, M3 as an example of a metric that we used to use and felt was extremely important in understanding future inflation trends that we just do not refer to now. And I think it's not that valuation doesn't matter. I'm certainly not suggesting it. But things like relative valuation as compared to investors' perception of safety, investors' perception of currency risk, right? You know, U.S. markets are certainly benefiting from investors wanting to park their assets in dollar-denominated investments, and just sort of macro fundamentals. And also to the degree that U.S. equities, particularly in the larger cap space, are proxies for global activity. And so people may increasingly feel like they're getting some of their global exposure via investing in U.S. markets rather than what might have been the case 10 to 20 years ago, where markets were indeed more national in their dynamics. Anyway, just something to think about. I don't know, David, if you want to have a quick response to that.
I suspect we're probably on the same page in as much as you're thinking from a macro perspective, economic perspective, where we have seen this huge distortion from central bank intervention that probably does change the way we should think about things like money supply. But my remarks were more around companies and thinking about what the market is discounting for the future earnings, cash flow, revenues of a company. We think, I wouldn't say it's timeless, but remains important.
And let's just turn to interest rates. I mean, obviously, interest rates spiked hugely in November, and actually very sharply, as I think a good reminder for investors that what is usually perceived as a staid and steady market, i.e. the bond market, versus a volatile market, i.e. the equity market. Bonds can be volatile, bonds can move quickly, bond prices can be upended. Certainly, we remember that from 2008. We should remember some of that again from 2011 in November, when there was another spasm of global bond markets around the potential of Greece departing the euro and the eurozone disintegrating. So, you know, bonds are stable and steady until they're not. And we saw very sharp moves in the 10-year yield in November. We saw some 30-year or longer-term bond funds lose 10 to 12 to 15% in price in the space of weeks, which, you know, for things that are yielding 3 or 4% is pretty significant. That's as much as 3 years of yield right there. Poof. So what do we think? Was this too far, too fast, kind of anticipating a degree of tumult in the bond markets that may not manifest? Yes, the Fed has indicated some gradual easing, but it's the lone central bank currently to be doing so, although the ECB did indicate that the end of very easy money is probably nigh, which will give way to just easy money. And it's not as if we're talking about an interest rate or inflation environment, anything like what we talked about from the 1930s to the, you know, early part of the new millennium. So just wondering what people expect for interest rates now after we've had this somewhat substantial reset in the past few months. Alexis, maybe you can kick us off on that.
Sure. I mean, I think over the course of last year, I think, you know, in the middle of the year, the outlook became rather depressing, and that was sort of priced into the bond market when you had Brexit and the Bank of England coming out and doing QE. You also had the ECB doing QE, which wasn't necessarily anticipated on that scale. And then towards the end of the year with the election of Donald Trump and this idea that perhaps inflation is going to return, the bond market reversed some of that pessimism. So in part, I think the bond market was probably getting too depressed in the middle of the year, pricing in very low inflation and very low growth, you know, for a medium to long term horizon. And so I think it was probably correcting back to something that looked a bit more healthy by the end of the year, now sort of seeing that, yes, we may achieve our 2% inflation targets and growth's not going to be depressed forever. So, you know, but that's sort of my view, that it was more of a healthy development. I don't think that markets are pricing in a sharp rise in interest rates, and I don't think that that's what we'll get. As I mentioned earlier, I think we see the Fed hiking rates two, possibly three times this year, and ending this cycle at a lower point than where they had historically, so maybe 2.5% at the end of this cycle. In the UK and the euro area, we don't see rates lifting off anytime soon. We don't see rates lifting off at all in Japan either. So for the rest of this decade, we're likely to have rates near zero. We're not really anticipating sharply higher interest rates, and I don't think that the bond market will reflect that either. So this sort of implies for bond investors that muted returns are here to stay for quite some time, which is unfortunate.
And Zachary, I would just say I would agree with Alexis, and I would just say that what we saw earlier in the year was this pessimism that Alexis alluded to. And then right around Brexit, again, it's the market, the equity market took off, and then right around Brexit, the U.S. 10-year yield just started to take off. So from that point just before the election, the 10-year yield started to ratchet up somewhat. It went from about 140 on the low end right around Brexit to about 180 prior to the election. So there was some idea that yes, interest rates were going to start to rise because of inflation. Maybe the economy was picking up. We had a couple of nice prints in terms of the employment situation, so that could have been driving the outlook a little bit. And then there was the confluence of both a more favorable economic outlook, and then on November 8th, election day, that's when the realization hit that yes, these policies that President-elect Trump had been trumpeting on the campaign trail may actually come into place. And so there was this idea that perhaps we're going to see higher inflation down the road, and I think that's what caused the steepening of the yield curve at the same time. So the yield curve had been flattening up through Brexit for a few quarters, actually, and then it started to steepen quite substantially after the election. So I think inflation expectations are a big part of the story there, but I think primarily it's the confluence of understanding, the Fed was going to raise rates in December. That was being baked in there after Brexit and pre-election, and then when the election hit, that was sort of the catalyst to drive it much higher. Now, in 2017, have we overshot? I'm not so sure. I don't see 10-year yields anyway rising substantially from here. I think the market is now pretty well assimilated this idea that the Fed has at least two more rate hikes in it this year, perhaps three, and so that's being baked in, and I think that will drive the outlook going forward. I think economic policy and what's passed in Congress will also be a big factor there as well.
That sounds good. We are at our witching hour. I'm glad that Brandon got a Trump pun in there, unintended. I think we've covered a good variety of topics from active passive to interest rates to valuations to markets. I'm sorry if we did not provide you with a simple, unequivocal roadmap as to exactly what will do well and what will do poorly over the year ahead. But I suppose if we all had such perfect crystal balls, we might not be on this call today. We've been saying at InvestNet that there is probably a decent likelihood for some bouts of volatility. We certainly haven't seen that as a result of an unexpected election, so that's a case where volatility, except for upside volatility in this case, or in the case of bonds, downside, but we didn't see the kind of volatility you might have expected on the other side of an unexpected election. Part of that just shows that often volatility erupts not when you expect it, but when you don't, not when it's in response to some global event that you could have predicted would create some uncertainty, but rather in response to something that no one saw coming. The hard thing about anticipating what no one sees coming is no one can see it coming. So I only say that when you think about the year ahead, in that there are things we know. We know there's going to be an election in France. We know there's going to be an election in Germany. We know there will be some policy changes from a Trump administration, both at the executive action level, and we know that Congress is likely to pass some legislation around taxes, potentially stimulus and healthcare, that will be a change
from what has been the norm for the past years. There's a lot we don't know, and that, I think, just augurs for and demands paying attention to your longer-term strategies, because it's very hard to guess the short-term. The short-term usually overreacts, and these long-term asset allocation strategies tend to do quite well and did extraordinarily well in 2016. Very, very good year for portfolios that were constructed with multi-asset classes, from bonds to stocks to some alternatives, and having that structured portfolio did very well. We'll obviously see how 2017 does, but the last year was a strong statement in favor of thinking about your longer-term goals, creating some parameters and sticking to those and not trying to constantly tack and ebb and flow based on both expected and unexpected shocks and hits to the markets. So we will see how the year goes. We'll probably try to do this mid-year as we have before. I want to thank our partners at Vanguard and American Funds and David and Alexis for their help and for their participation and for their insights today. And I think with that, and of course Brandon Thomas, my colleague at InvestNet, with that, as I said, we are here to assist. And do we need some final comments just to let people know where to go and what to do? Madeline, do you want to add anything at the end?
I just wanted to say thank you to everybody for joining and attending, and that we will send out a replay shortly after the call.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a great day.